Hi, welcome back to the Pleasure Project. This is Dr. Jen Kennedy. So, in this episode, I sit down with Rebecca Lovejoy. She is a therapist, and we talk about non-monogamy. So, we talk about how consensual non-monogamy differs from other types of polyamory. We talk about contracting between folks, specifically how LGBT populations differ. So it's a really good conversation. If you're curious about it, maybe you're trying it out or thinking about trying it out this year. It's a great episode. It's juicy and it's informative. We really unpack a lot of things that I think people want to ask but just don't understand. So tune in and I look forward to your feedback. All right. So, welcome to my guest today. That is Rebecca Lovejoy, PhD and AMFT. So, Rebecca is an associate marriage and family therapist, and I will note with Riviera Therapy. So, I do know her personally. Her specialties include somatic psychology, LGBT plus populations, non-monogamy, archetypal psychology, and mythopoetic modalities. She works with an integrative, existential, humanistic approach that leverages mindfulness, somatic awareness, EMDR, and the latest trauma awareness techniques. She's evidence-based in her psychodynamic treatments, and she respects the whole person, which I think is really important in this approach. Her goal is the support of individuals, meaning-making for her clients in any circumstances, with the intent of bringing thriving, ease, and a feeling of safety in themselves and in the world. Rebecca is also a published author and subject matter expert for undergraduate curriculums, specializing in pop culture, media studies and film, critical thinking, American studies, social justice, and the study of utopian and alternative social structures. Rebecca worked for many years with UX and the architecture of larger Fortune 500 streaming websites. Totally a different time and place, but I love that you've got kind of both parts of it of your mind. So she is here today to talk with me about consensual non-monogamy. And tell me what drew you to your specialties, which includes that as well as the things I had mentioned before, somatic, LGBTQ, you know, sort of what how have you landed in this specialty?
My interest in alternative family systems comes from growing up in the counterculture, which had a lot of experimental family systems and a lot of variable attachment styles. And so that was already deeply connected to my own attachment style. And I spent years sort of exploring my perspective on loving many people. And on, where that comes from and what it looks like and why some people struggle with it and some people lean into it. And that expanded as I became an adult and started thinking about sexuality.
And also, just for the listeners who don't know what counterculture means, give us a quick definition.
So the counterculture is often described as hippies, but it's actually all of the people that came out of the New Left 1960s alternative lifestyles, which included a lot of variations on collective housings and, co-ops and communes and alternative ways of parenting and loving.
Great. All right, so let's just do some basic definitions here. Can you explain what non-monogamy is and how it differs from monogamous relationships?
Well, non-monogamy is variable. There are lots and lots of different styles of non-monogamy. In a nutshell, it means loving more than one person successfully at the same time. But the configurations of that are creative and very personal to each grouping of people.
Okay, and why do some couples choose this path?
Well, it's interesting.
Over monogamy.
Yeah. So it's interesting because there are a lot of people who choose this path unsuccessfully, sort of as a panic response to not having a functional current coupling. And that's its own category, but there's also the people who consciously do it with intent to succeed at more than one relationship at the same time, have all sorts of reasons why they're drawn to it. But, you know, for me, I kind of describe it as the difference between a person who's sort of a chimpanzee person and a person who's a bonobo person. There are people in the world that really genuinely and authentically love a bunch of different people very consciously and can handle multiple relationships at the same time. The configurations will often be very different. Sometimes it's that a couple found another person that they love and they brought them into their relationship. Sometimes it's a couple that wants to, you know, create a primary pod with each other and then have individual exploration in a conscious way. Sometimes I've interacted with people who have created an entire household that's in relationship with each other. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, sometimes it leans a little bit into, you know, more culty, you know, religious-y kinds of things, which is usually not as successful, but in a grounded form, it's often starts with the realization that there is a genuine solid connection with more than one person.
Mm-hmm. I find too that in the couples that I've seen in this space, they actually, when they do it successfully, to your caveat, they are the best communicators.
Absolutely. That's one of the reasons I, you know, really differentiate the ones who are sort of knee-jerk doing it because their relationship isn't working versus the ones who are consciously going in to mm-hmm. successfully be in a non-monogamous relationship. There needs to be a really intensified communication and intimacy, actually, because it's not just using your words, it's using your emotion words and being really authentic about yourself, what you're experiencing for yourself, so that you can identify when you're struggling and name it. It's actually much harder work than a monogamous mm-hmm. relationship.
I've also, you know, heard that delineation between consensual and non-consensual non-monogamy, because sometimes, and I've definitely had couples in this space, one really wants the non-monogamy and one doesn't. So they're going along with it, but they're actually not really interested in it.
And that, I feel like that often falls into the category of not really doing it because they, as a couple, want to be doing it. Mm-hmm. It is usually something where one of the members is feeling unseen, or they're not articulating their needs in a coherent way. And so they're kind of pushing towards opening up a relationship, thinking that that will support their needs in a bigger sphere. And it goes both directions, because, you know, that sometimes the person who's saying yes but doesn't mean it is the one who's not articulating their needs.
Right.
You know, so either member is in an unbalance. So it's really imperative that the couple be able to both have their use of communication, knowing how to name their experiences, knowing what their desire levels are and their reasons why they're in it, which is why a lot of times a successful non-monogamous relationship includes contract writing,
right.
which is a huge piece of polyamory.
That was my next question. How does contracting work? So of course, it sounds like you do recommend it. And how does that process look when you're doing it in a facilitated capacity with couples?
So, you know, one of the first steps is to, you know, you can go online and people have posted, you know, examples of polyamorous mm-hmm. contracts. So you can go online and kind of get a sense of what people are saying and what they're defining. but it's really a very intensive, structured description of what each of the members of the primary couple usually want. Mm-hmm. This is where it gets complicated, because sometimes it's like a third has been brought in and then there's a contract between the three of them. Mm-hmm. But usually it's a, you know, because of the society we're in, usually people start out in what seems like a pairing mm-hmm. of a monogamous relationship, and then they realize they want to open, in which case they're the primary partners to begin with as they're writing their contract. And they each go away and come up with their own desires and their own needs, but also their own fears and their own sort of worst case scenarios to be able mm-hmm. to communicate what they think will be a working system that covers, you know, a lot of,
because you have to go through a lot of the scenarios, right? It's almost like when you write a prenup or something, right? You have to think of how this might end, or what are some of the pitfalls that we might encounter, right? Or how anticipate things that have never occurred before that could present. So they have to really kind of think through and have kind of scary conversations about, you know, and it's not just one, it's conversations, right? This is a fluid, changing process.
Yes, just like any contract writing, there's going to be all of these processes going along. And then once that contract has been agreed upon, cases will arise that are not addressed in the contract. So even as you go, you're going to want to have kind of a fluid, flexible way of thinking about it, because, you know, all of a sudden something occurs, you know, a partner, like, you know, mm-hmm. an example is, you know, I was working with a couple where they had specified they only wanted to have relationships outside of marriage with people who were already married. Mm-hmm. And so they were doing that, except that one of the external secondary partners got divorced and then suddenly was single, and that hadn't been addressed in their contract. And so they had to go back and revisit that.
The other piece of this too is that we don't always know how we're going to actually feel until we're in a situation. So you might contract it a certain way, and then when that circumstance actually happens, you can't handle what you thought you could, or you don't feel okay about it anymore. And so it needs to be negotiated.
Yeah.
And again, that's where the honesty and the maturity comes in with participating.
Yeah. And even past honesty, there has to be kind of a worldview that mm-hmm. life is process, not goal, because mm-hmm. the process of being in non-monogamy is much more creative, in that you're kind of rolling with what's going to happen and noticing and incorporating that in. Now, life is always like that. And to be honest, relationships are always like that. Even when I'm dealing with monogamous sure. couples, I work towards that goal. But it's a lot easier to have rules and consistency when there's just the two of you than when there's external forces involved. And mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, sometimes the non-monogamy gets pretty intense, where people have a whole array of different relationships with
right.
other configurations.
So also, if you could talk about the hierarchical options, because just because you start in a twosome doesn't mean that twosome has more priority or significance.
Yeah. And it does if that's the contract. So, right. The language is usually that there's the primary relationship, and then there's secondary relationships, and then there's, you know, sort of what I would call tertiary relationships, which is people that are just for fun and not really relationship, but there's a freedom to play. Mm-hmm. So you can have contracts with your partner where all the other people are just freedom to play and nobody's allowed to fall in love with anyone else. Or you can have secondary relationships, which are people that you're actually creating deeper ties with that are consistent and long-term, but they're not your primary. But, you know, when now we're getting into a world where there are people walking into a sexuality of non-monogamy, and so they actually live in an environment where they may have more than one partner that they consider to be a primary for them.
Right.
And so it's starting, you know, the language is still progressing too. It's just as creative as the experience. So I think we're going to start having even more potential titles along the way.
Let's talk about some misconceptions of this world, because I feel like there is a misunderstanding sometimes of what this is about. Is it just lots of orgies? No, that's not typically what we're talking about.
No, it isn't. And in fact, one of the things that I find that kind of makes my skin crawl a little bit is when someone tells me that they're non-monogamous and what they really mean is that they're into hookup culture. Because that's not conscious non-monogamy. That's just sleeping around, which is fine if that's what you're doing and you're not hurting anyone. I am a sex positive therapist, so I'm not going to shame that at all, but it's not non-monogamy in the context we're describing. What you're describing is actually connecting with people and actually having more than one person that you love. And the way I describe it is, you know, I have three children and I love all of my children actually the same, though in different ways. I love each of them for their uniqueness and who they are. And I don't, in fact, pick a favorite. Now, there are some people that will pick a favorite and they can't help themselves. That's the kind of person they are. And so, you know, that's just a different kind of person. I genuinely don't have a favorite kid. And that's what polyamory, you know, and non-monogamy in a conscious way really genuinely is. These are real relationships.
How do you see it play out when only one person in the couple pursues polyamory and the other person does not? So we've got a monopoly combo.
If that is a thing because they've agreed upon it. So, you know, sometimes we discover for whatever reason, like it was always the way we were, or something happened to our bodies in some way that we're either demisexual or asexual. And we still are deeply in love with our partner, but we don't want to have sex with them anymore. There are people that do that. This happens a lot with menopause. You know, in Europe, it happens for all kinds of reasons. They just have a different culture around that. But it's, you know, the contract becomes you can go and do these other things. Now, within that, there's a lot of extra stipulation because one of the partners is not necessarily as sexually involved usually, or they're just, this is their only partner. It creates a weird attention imbalance. So it's really important to have pretty clear language as you're going in.
Attention balance, meaning who gets the attention, who gets the date nights, who gets the, who gets the priority, that type of thing.
And it's also really imperative to make sure that that's not happening out of manipulation. Like that's one of the ones where a lot of times there's a convincing that we're going to do it this way. And it's a way for one member of the couple to not really examine themselves. And again, either or, you know, it can be the one who's not sleeping around, isn't examining their sexual conversations. And so because they're limiting the sexual life of the couple, the other member who's often higher desire ends up in a situation where they're kind of like, I don't want to leave you, but I need to have sex. So that can happen. Or the other direction, you know, the person who is choosing to go out and have more sex is somehow coercing because they really don't want to do, they either don't want to drop into the intimacy that they have in their couple, or for whatever reason, they need to have these externals as well without wanting their partner to also sleep around. I've seen that as well. Like, mm-hmm. I want to go sleep around, but I don't want you to.
Yeah. I've read studies where if anonymously polled, most people would love to have additional partners as long as their spouse didn't do it too.
That's fair.
Right? Because that's like, of course, it's easy that way. You know,
yeah.
It's
yeah.
Not, and not so easy when you both have it.
Yeah. The emotionality of sharing is one of mm-hmm. the biggest things that people run into when it actually comes time to sitting down with their primary partner and hearing about the good time that their partner had with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people shrink up. It's like mm-hmm. they don't, it's, you know, the ideal is that you feel a sense of joy that your partner had some mm-hmm. pleasure and is connecting with another human being, but that isn't often the case.
Right. And we're not just talking about like sexual specifics. We're talking about interpersonal dynamics, right? They're enjoying the company of another, and they're getting some of their needs met through another, and that can feel threatening.
Yes. And it can be like vacations. It can be like gift giving. Mm-hmm. It can be, mm-hmm. you know, like holidays or birthdays or all of these mm-hmm. things. You know, one of the big conversations in the non-monogamy world is the difference between jealousy versus envy. And that's that conversation mm. a lot that has to be tagged, because one is saying, I don't want that other person to have that, only I want it. And the other mm-hmm. one is saying, I want it too. How can I have it too? And
right.
so in non-monogamy, you have to be constantly sort of making sure that you're staying in the I want it too.
Because mm-hmm.
if you get to a place where you're like, it's, you know, it's a zero-sum game and you don't want the other person to have what you have, you're kind of not in non-monogamy anymore.
Right. That like it blocks the flow that is so beautiful in this dynamic, right? Is if only I get to have the pleasure, but you don't actually get to, and I'm not thrilled for you to also have good, you know, good experiences.
Yes.
Yeah. I have seen it also working with a couple, a male-female couple, where the female was able to get lots of dates and the male not so much. And so it was just a matter of like who was available, and you know, I guess, and so it was circumstance. They were both open for it, but he ended up kind of getting left with nothing, and she had lots of opportunity, and so that just it created some imbalance and some frustration on his part, and some like guilt on her part. Like she felt kind of bad about it for him.
And it's kind of an interesting thing, because in essence, you know, when you go out to do non-monogamy, you're back in the marketplace, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you're just at the whims of human desire and human choices and, you know, all the things that often are the reason people get married, so they don't have to do them anymore, right?
Right. And you're even a subset,
yeah,
right? So
yeah, because you're not really necessarily available. It's not like whole hog.
right. It's not like the whole world opens up for you. Actually, it's like let's see what else. The idea too that sometimes polyamory is in service of maybe having same-sex couple relationships if you're in a straight relationship. I know that's definitely come up. And so then some of the contracting around that, where maybe only one of you wants to see same-sex and the other one doesn't. And how does that get
considered? That's a really interesting thing, because, you know, I've talked with couples where they were only primary and monogamous in their in their binary roles, but the partner who was bisexual had infinite allowance for same-sex relationships, and they were fine with that. And then I've talked to other couples where, you know, one of the members of the couple was bisexual and there was absolutely no allowance for that, because a relationship is a relationship. And so the idea that, you know, somehow the homosexual relationship was going to be different was just absolutely not acceptable.
Which kind of makes sense to me, actually, because I think a relationship is a relationship and it doesn't matter.
It absolutely is. However, one of the interesting and ironic things about a lot of people who are bisexual or pansexual, they're often naturally polyamorous as well. So, you know, that choosing to be in a singular relationship can often be a struggle for them if they're going towards, you know, either direction of their sexuality. So that's, you know, it's a strange extra hook that has to be dealt with, which is a self-examination, really.
Yeah. So how do you navigate when you're working with couples that sort of new relationship energy that invariably happens, right? Because when any of us are newly seeing somebody, it's exciting. There's that, you know, there's literally chemical things happening in your brain, but there's a lot of mystery. There's a lot of projection. And so the person at home is like tried and true, and you know what they are, and they're kind of boring sometimes. And this new little shiny thing is quite different. And so they're all like whirled up about that.
Yeah.
And that creates probably some, maybe some tension or some jealousy.
And so this, where it's, when it's a conscious non-monogamy, a lot of the reason that they're consciously creating the contract is because this is a safe home base. So the way that I usually, you know, sort of play with that is that the fresh thing is the excitement that they're bringing back home to the coupling, which is part of the reason for wanting to open a relationship, is to keep having that libido, you know, because the libido charges and then it charges everything. When we're, you know, we know this from poets and painters for centuries, right? They're constantly having a muse, and the muse helps them to create their other things. So, you know, that love experience is actually really fuels creativity. And I go both directions with this. This is how I examine people who are not successfully having the non-monogamy as well, is like, okay, well, you know, if what you're looking for is libido and creativity, what are the other ways that you can generate libido and creativity, right? But it is that new love is a great way to get it. It's
like a catalyst for, that's a great, reframe, right? As long as that energy can not feel threatening to the partner at home and instead feel invigorating, right? It's bringing air and openness and ideas about maybe what lights you up and what interests you. And that's just information, right? That's it doesn't have to be.
And in fact, if it's a really successful non-monogamous relationship, there's joy from both partners that there's this feeling, right? So they're both celebrating that.
Right. I'm happy for your happiness and joy.
Well, and also I'm actually getting some of the libido, because actually both partners get it. That's the fun part.
How do you suggest that people in these configurations navigate having people over? Like, what, you know, if you're both in partnerships, where do you have sex? Like, or does one person vacate? Are you home but you're aware? Like, how does that happen?
I mean, to be honest, this is where you start to notice that non-monogamy is either sort of very laissez-faire, or it's kind of a privileged sport. Because a lot of times you go somewhere else, you know, unless you're picking partners who themselves have their own spaces. If everybody's got mutual spaces, and it really depends, right, on the configuration. Sometimes it's couples with other couples, and they're choosing couple relationships, and then it doesn't really matter. It's who's ever kids aren't home.
right.
But if it's a situation where it's, you know, a married couple and they have singles, they may go to that space, or they may have to be getting hotel rooms.
Yeah, I've also seen couples where they like went to a resort, met other people, made some friends, and now those friends, like it might be two or three or four couples, will meet up at each other's homes in different places and have you know, kind of longer weekends
and that's, you know, because there's
exchange.
There's a whole variety of cultural like spaces for, you know, the sex positive community, for example, where there's even, you know, sex parties and that kind of thing that are happening at the same time. And in those spaces, sometimes there's individual rooms, and, you know, some of that is more expanded, like kind of out there sex. It's not like, you know, that's way beyond the the norm. But that, you know, a lot of it lives in that space. So those are places where people start to get creative.
So I know one of the populations that you work with quite a bit is LGBTQ, and I want to kind of think about like the intersection of queer and consensual non-monogamy. I definitely see a lot of queer clients, and I would say for the most part, the male identified folk doing it quite a lot, the female, not so much.
Yeah.
But what's your, what's been your experience?
I think that, you know, there is a permissiveness to non-monogamy in the male gay community that's been there from the beginning. There's a very long standing, almost tradition of it. In fact, a lot of the time with my gay male couples, I'm working with them to learn how to have monogamy, because that's harder than the idea they get non-monogamy. The monogamy is very intense and hard for them. And, you know, there's a huge story around that. And a lot of it has to do with the AIDS epidemic, because there was starting to be modeling for having real relationships, and all of those men died. So it's kind of a tragic thing, but that's the residue. With female queer relationships, there's actually a trend to immediately go monogamous and be pretty intense about it in a totally different way. And then there's some fallout to that that's also really interesting, you know, around what's often called bed death. So a lot of times when women are opening their relationship, it actually is more mechanistic. It actually is trying to survive the scenario of their sexuality, and in fact usually really strongly examining another alternative first is a better choice.
Within the family therapy realm, we talk about open and closed relationships, meaning open and able to have other stimuli come in, other ideas, other friends, versus the closed, where basically we do everything together, we agree on everything, you know, like the threat of outside. And lesbians in particular seem like they can really get into that closed configuration.
They really do.
And it sucks all the oxygen out of the relationship.
It does. And it's really, you know, unfortunate that that immediately creates that lack of libido. So, you know, as much as they're often, you know, defining themselves as best friends, they're usually like completely tired of the sexuality with each other much faster. And it's in that scenario, the idea that bringing someone else in is going to freshen it doesn't usually work. It just creates, you know, the move to another place.
Right. It ends up feeling threatening to both. And then oftentimes it triangulates and then, yeah.
And, you know, there's so many reasons for that culturally. You know, our society is set up for women to be in cliquish behavior by nature. So the best friend, you're no longer my best friend thing is already embedded into women's society. So when you get it in, you add sexuality, it gets really bad.
And yet there's also the dynamic of, because the queer community is relatively small, that most of the time there is sort of a, you know, whereas heterosexual people, when they break up, they move apart. Queer people are still hanging out together.
That's right.
Right. So it's not consensual non-monogamy, but it's sort of like there's been multiple connections over the years
That's
those around them.
It's not like a crash and burn. Well, I have seen crash and burn where it's like, you know, we just don't speak anymore. I'm never going to, I don't even talk to your family. Right. That's it. But it does also, a lot of times there's, you know, they're still banded together unless they move out of town. Right. Which is, that's the method. It's interesting because I think that because of found family, there's a lot of configurations of non-sexual non-monogamy. It's like we're already poly by nature in that everybody,
like the Boston marriage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're kind of touching on this a little bit, but let's like discuss the impact of societal norms and stigmas on non-monogamy or on the idea of like keeping your primary intact, not going for divorce, but expanding it in this way.
Yeah, it has a lot of really strange implications. I think on one level, because it's a little bit taboo, it's sometimes more titillating for people to try it. So that's one piece of it, but it also requires a lot more secretiveness for people who are in professional careers, or are in some way responsible, or they're, you know, political, whatever that is. We're starting to have jokes in popular culture about people coming out as having always been in a throuple, but
right.
It's like, you know, it really is very taboo. So, it's hard. It creates secrets where with people who would normally not be secretive. And so, you know, especially when you're going for conscious non-monogamy, that's by its nature a very like, I'm saying all the things, I'm completely revealed, you know, I know myself and I'm proud of it. And then you're out in the world and you're lying about it. So it's, you know, it can be really complicated and damaging, to the relationship in some ways. That
where right, because there's a minimizing of or a hiding of the importance or the value of one of the partners, you know, one or more of the partners.
Right, and it adds another layer to the requirements of connecting, because like I've worked with couples where one member of the couple is really afraid of being outed. And the other one is less afraid of it and kind of wants to just do it and be out in the world with it. And it's not, and the first couple member is feeling really like they're not being respected in their fear. So it's like, actually the open relationship part isn't an issue, but the saying it out loud to the rest of the world is.
Right. Yeah. Last summer I had a party and I had a, throuple RSVP. And I was like, okay. And 1 year later, they RSVP'd again, all three of them. And I was like, oh, they stayed together. Look at that. Because I was like, is it different? Is it different? Nope, it's the same person. All right. We've still got that throuple.
And it's kind of funny how it's like, it's such an odd thing in our, in our society. It's so not normative that we are surprised when it lasts. You know, it's like, that's sort of, you're kind of like an alien if you actually manage to stay consistently non-monogamous with the same people your whole life.
What about parents who are in this configuration?
I mean, so, you know, on the one hand, if you're clear and conscious and you're being like in your integrity, you're already a better parent than everyone else. So,
true. You know,
kids will grow up with whatever it is. And, you know, I've known kids who lived in cults, right? Who, as long as everybody was being kind and loving, were able to get through that. That's not usually the case. Cults are actually quite damaging. I just want to say that. It, you know, it's like the scenario and the configuration of loving people doesn't damage children. It does create complications around like school events and friends coming over, depending on, you know, the friendships that your kids have. So it's not easy, but it's, as far as like actual like issues with the children themselves, that's usually not a problem.
Yep, that makes sense. So kind of dipping into your depth side of things. So using kind of the archetypal psychology to understand the pull towards this, or the curiosity about, and the desire and motivation to be poly.
So, you know, our psyches have a lot of internal pieces. even in Jungian and more so in the later archetypal psychology, we describe the idea that we have these internal characters in us, personas, that are part of our expression. And, you know, just like with a normative relationship, a lot of times we are picking our loving partner based on what's actually our internal self, our soul self. Mm-hmm. Jung calls that the anima or animus. We do that with all of these different parts of us. So, you know, the pieces of us, James Hillman likes to say, you know, we're not an I, we're a pantheon. Like, the I is just the ego, and the ego should be the servant who makes sure we cross the street without getting run over. But we have all of these other people inside of us that have grown from our experiences, from, you know, our whatever our soul is sort of connected to. And a whole person is integrated, so they're all in conversation with each other. But that doesn't mean that those people don't desire different things. So, you know, having those attachments to multiple people is usually because some part of our own self-expression is uniquely interested in this other human being, which is very different from the other part of ourselves, which is uniquely interested in somebody else, right?
Well, intuitively, that makes sense because we have different friends and different friendships that serve parts of us. Like, we understand that from that. It's just then kind of having it be a deeper sexual relationship.
And some of this is, it's important to know that humans have always been polyamorous. This isn't like a new trend that it just existed. Mm-hmm. If you go back into some of the ancient texts, like one of our oldest human stories is the Mahabharata, which comes out of India. And it's, you know, what we mostly know about in the West is a very small section of it called the Bhagavad Gita, but that's embedded inside of a frame story of a group of people that are traveling through this huge adventure. And it's a woman who's married to seven brothers, and they're all, you know, happy.
Oh, sounds exhausting. Right.
But that's, you know, that's the nature of that. It's like we've had and always have had these long-standing relationships. Our oldest big hero story is, you know, out of Sumer. And it's got, you know, a trinity of people. It's a throuple, basically. And they're an adventure together. This is something we just do. Mm-hmm. So, for whatever reason. And when we do it, it's an expression of our creativity, you know, just like any other way of expressing ourselves. Sexuality is a piece of our creative expression.
And to your point, there's always been interest in others as a common human condition. It's just, we're talking about consensual non-monogamy, right? Where you're actually upfront about it. You're open about this desire. You're planning, you're negotiating, you know, you're really being fully open and honest with all parties involved versus like having this thing on the side, which feels very different.
And, you know, just from the like super duper cultural, you know, whatever, consistently in the ancient past, matriarchies were actually polyamorous, and patriarchies are where we get this, you know, only one wife at a time. It's actually only one husband. In a lot of those cultures over the centuries, men were allowed to have many wives, but in order to track their parenting, the women were not allowed to go the other direction. So, you know, some of this is actually, it's contractual in a wrong way.
So for listeners who are interested maybe in looking more into this, you mentioned you could find contracts online. What are some other resources that you might suggest?
Yeah, so the book Ethical Slut is a good one. And also there's a book called Polysecure. And those do go deeper into pieces of the culture and pieces of, you know, the ways of thinking. And, you know, this is a growing trend in our current society. So there's actually new books coming out all the time.
Right. And I always say, hey, like, there's no reason to rush into this. Ideally, couples are reading one of these books or starting to sort of do some information gathering, because if your knee-jerk reaction is to run out and do this, it's probably not going to go well. So do it with some intention and some planning, and it's gonna help. I also would say do it with the support of a therapist, ideally, a couples therapist who is open to the idea and somewhat experienced with the configuration, so that they can talk you through it and really help you unpack what works best for you.
And also to identify the places where you're not clear in yourself about what mm-hmm. you want and don't want. The conversations often with couples are pretty intense. A lot of stuff comes to the forefront. You know, a lot of early childhood attachment things arrive.
Yeah, you hit little tripwires you didn't realize were there, because it's not just in this neat package. It starts to really, expand and keep you open and vulnerable to surprises.
Yeah, because the reality is what people want in their relationships is very different from person to person. Mm-hmm. You know, like some people really are looking for a sense of security and consistency, where other people are looking for their muse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's very different.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes we're not always completely aware or honest with ourselves about what we really want and what is going to serve us best.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's having exposure to it, or even the idea that it's possible.
Yeah. It's, I mean, you know, a lot of people walk into their adulthood in a very big structured supposed to, where they're following, mm-hmm. you know, the pattern that they were told they needed to. And it often takes them, you know, a lot of the people that I have in my practice who are exploring this are older, because they've gotten past that first phase of, you know, settling their households and doing all the things and becoming successful. And they realize that a whole part of their self is not being expressed. And now they're like, okay, wait, it's time for me to question this system mm-hmm. that I was buying into.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that definitely the folks I've seen are coming into it with some curiosity and some intentionality about wanting it to go well, but also kind of having this thing in the back of their mind for quite a long time that this might be the avenue that would serve them best.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today. Yeah. You can find Rebecca at her website, RebeccaLovejoyTherapy.com. She is also offering services through Riviera Therapy. So if you would like to book an appointment with her, reach out. And thanks so much.
Thank you. This was fun.